Something good by doing something in a different area. Do you have any idea of how that might be achieved in any other mechanism and what's in the plan at the moment?
In terms of enabling an increase in one contaminant if you're decreasing another?
Yeah. Can you see any basis on which that could be achieved through an RMA process?
Well, to be honest, I don't
struggling with at the moment, so if people can help us, that would be good. Now, the other one that is relevant here is the issue of overseer. And I'm not going to ask you any technical questions about overseer. This is purely a planning question. I've also raised the issue of future allocation of loads that each farm can will be required to comply with. At this stage, I imagine that there will, at some stage, need to be a requirement to get farms to reduce their loads. That's my expectation. In fact, it's not an unreasonable expectation when there's too much going on at the present time. And my understanding also is that the only tool that's ever been used for allocation in New Zealand is overseer. And so my question to you is to ensure there is protection for that option remains an option in the future. If MFE, for example, comes back and says, with these improvements, it could be appropriate as an allocation tool. So for that reason and a number of other reasons, I can see some merit in keeping overseer in there and leaving the option for a range of tools to be used as the consent gateway. Do you see any problem in that approach from a consent, from a planning point of view?
I think, and I understand Mr. Turelka has concern with implementing multiple tools from the council perspective, but also that there could be some gaming in which tool you use. But I think that, from my limited understanding, that if you set the thresholds essentially for each tool so that they are equivalent, then it shouldn't matter which tool you use to achieve your outcome. So I think that there should be space for multiple tools if those tools can be all sort of benchmarked in a similar way to give the council and the playing users some certainty that everyone's playing the same playing field.
Along those lines, even if there is a little bit of gaming and it's not extensive in terms of the options in front of us now, it may still be the best way to go. Will you accept that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Now, the other one that I've also raised, in fact, I know I've raised a lot of issues, but the practicability and the timing issue concerns me greatly. And we have many situations where we don't have enough information to make properly informed decisions. And therefore, setting exact time frames for certain things may not be the right thing to do. And again, from a planning point of view, where we have an idea that something should be done in 2 years, but it may be 3 or 5 or something like that, we just don't know. How would you feel about wording of that a certain thing has to be achieved as far as practicable within 2 years, say, that's what people are talking about, and in any event, within 5 years. So there's an indication of what's expected, but there is flexibility to go more within defined limits.
Yeah, I think that would be useful, and I think that would potentially address a lot of concerns with the time frames that are imposed.
Yeah, and then picking up on your idea that at some stage in the future, if you can't do it in 5 years or whatever the figure is, you may need to go to a consent application.
Yeah.
It's not straight away.
Yeah, I think that could work.
I think those are all my points, but I do think that some changes to Clause 5 are needed. What we're talking about is we're actually talking about effects. We're not talking about reducing individual contaminants, but the act requires consideration of effects. And I would thought there was some wording along those lines that would make it much clearer, but still leave you with the difficulty of knowing how you actually assess those effects across all contaminants.
Yeah, I think that'd be great.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed, Pierre.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's just one thing that I probably should have taken up previously, but I'll raise now, and you may not be able to look at it, or you may not. Well, your wording, your suggested wording, policy 5, your paragraph 239, gets rid of the problem or the apparent problem. If you could look at policy 5 in the post-conferencing version, in paragraph B, it just seems to me that the current wording I think, too many verbs in it. It says any increase in the diffuse discharge of one of the contaminants from the property is compensated by a reduction in diffuse discharge of those contaminants not increasing. And I suppose it's the whole thing of is compensated by a reduction not increasing. And I'm just not sure if that's right. Is that how you understand the first part of B, or am I missing something in the way in which that's worded?
Well, I guess I have interpreted compensated to mean compensated in terms of the effects management hierarchy.
It's by a reduction not increasing, I suppose, is the way I propose. And I would have thought it would make more sense if it was simply that any increase in the diffuse discharge is compensated by a reduction in diffuse discharge, and that the words not increasing are surplus.
Yeah, I guess I tend to agree. I guess my concern is that it assumes that you are increasing one.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
I understand the substance issue, and I'm not asking you about that. I understand your evidence about that. I think that's what the Commission was asking about as well. The whole point is that trading, the contaminants are not themselves commensurable. They aren't directly related to one another. So I understand that's the substantive problem. I was just looking at the words. I suppose I should just ask you that, in terms of what the trading might amount to, or what the offset or compensation might amount to, you had a number of questions put to you about what if there was only a small increase in one contaminant that might be notionally offset by a significant reduction in another, or the effects of another. Are you aware from any of the work you've done in PC1 of a real world example of that?
I'm not, no.
Thank you.
Your Honour, could I just, in view of the fact that you looked at specific words, could I just put something to you in terms of Clause A of Policy 5?
Yes.
And I wondered whether a way of getting the words a little bit closer to what the Act is talking about is there is an overall reduction in the adverse effects on the environment in the relevant subcontaminants. So you're talking about a reduction in the adverse effects on the environment, which is what the Act is all about,
yeah,
resulting from the combined discharge of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and microbial pathogens. From an RMA perspective, might that work better than looking at the individual contaminants?
I think it might. I think it would depend on the subcatchment and exactly what's happening within that subcatchment, because it might be that each of the four contaminants needs to be reduced comparatively, but it may be that one is particularly an issue in that subcatchment, and I guess my concern might be that grouping them together would give the wrong message rather than looking at each individually. But I understand what you're saying, that it's the overall reduction. So I'm not sure I understand.
And it's the effects on the environment.
It is the effects of the environment.
And that's
right.
Not clear from A at the moment.
That's right.
That's not my concern. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I think some rewording to build in those concepts might be helpful.
I think you're right.
Thank you very much.
Well, you haven't taken that one step further, I'm going to I wonder if the trading, if you're concerned about trading in A, it talks about an overall reduction in the relevant subcatchments. But in terms of when the policy might be applied, would it make sense that it is actually an overall reduction on the relevant property or the relevant farm operation of the discharges? And then it would simply be for the applicant to demonstrate what they were doing rather than trading with their neighbour or seeking to gain something as a result of something which their neighbour is doing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the proper scale at which that reduction is viewed might be useful.
Because I don't think as the Commissioner has said, and you've agreed, no one is actually advocating for setting up a trading regime, are they?
Not as far as I'm aware, no.
There's no cap and trade type mechanism in any of this.
No.
So in terms of doing the accounting, doing it at a sub-catchment level would be, some of the sub-catchments are actually quite large, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Anything arising from the court questions? Comment.
Thank you, Your Honour. Yes, just one matter. So a matter arising out of the question His Honour asked about policy 5B, and as I look at those words, it makes me think any time you need to read something multiple times in order to work out what it says, it probably gets used more clearly, which I think is the point that was well made. And I want to test with you in terms of your understanding of what those words in the Council's version are intended to convey, but imperfectly. Is it your understanding it should be that the underlying words should be read as compensated by a reduction in diffuse discharge of those contaminants that are not increasing in depth? Like saying that if there is an increase in one contaminant, the other three need to decrease. Is it your understanding of what's intended to be conveyed by that?
Yes, I think that's right. I guess what I'm just clear on is if there's an increase in three contaminants, does that mean that you can reduce in one and that would still meet the requirement of 5B? Which I think you could read it that way.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I think you can come by that. That is another way of looking at it. And whether, well, it could be wordsmith. We won't do that on the hook.
Thank you.
Any other matters arising? No? Thank you very much for your evidence, Minister. You're excused.
Thank you, sir. That concludes the Director General's case.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Mann. Next, we have the list,
Yes, and I'm assuming the court has some degree of familiarity with those now.
Yes, and with the role and the statutory framework for the authority.
Yes. So certainly I don't intend to read our submissions. What I'd like to do is highlight the key points as I go through. And in doing that, I'll take up the opportunity to reflect on some of the matters discussed so far in the hearing.
Thank you.
And I think it's fair to say my focus will be more on the back end of the submissions in terms of the provision and the funding, which I know you're well familiar with. So at the outset, the Waikato River Authority acknowledges the appeals by the River Iwi and other Iwi partners and acknowledges and respects the role and mana of Iwi in their respective areas of interest over the Waikato and Waipa rivers. So that's a really important starting point for the River Authority. In terms of the overview of our submissions, I won't take you through those, other than to just emphasise the River Authority's formal role in these proceedings. So that's starting at paragraph 8. And again, I won't read that, but to confirm, the River Authority is an appellant in its own right, and its appeal was limited to, I think, only five appeal points. focused almost entirely on the treatment of lakes and wetlands in PC1, and that reflects that those water bodies are a real priority for the WRA. As of the start of this hearing, there are only two remaining live appeal points for the River Authority, and both of those would be resolved via the provisions as now proposed by the Council. So I'll come back to those matters later, but briefly they're about setback distances for lakes and wetlands, and the prioritisation of lakes in the consenting processes. And by prioritisation I mean the time at which the staggered requirement for application for resource consent kicks in respect of those important lakes. Beyond its own appeal, the River Authority is a Section 274 party to all other appeals in this process. And the WRA has endeavoured to take a big picture focus in this process, and that's centred on two key themes. The first is ensuring there is no weakening of the decision's version of Plan Change 1. The River Authority's position is that the outcomes to be achieved under the final version of PC1 that put in place by this court should be the same as or better than what they would be under the Council-level decisions version. And the second key theme for the River Authority has been encouraging a timely and efficient process in resolving appeals. And that's particularly because, as you heard from my friend Mr. Conway, that most of the provisions of PC1 are currently not in effect, and that will be the case until this plan change is operative. And just taking a step right back, the overall driver for the River Authority is ensuring that PC1 gives effect to FOMO. And perhaps putting a gloss on that, and this has been a real point of discussion, that it's a strong first step in ultimately giving effect to FOMO. That's really important for the River Authority. So at 14 and 15, we've just briefly noted the evidence for the River Authority. So Mr. Pinter and Ms. Rademacher are here today. I just wanted to pause briefly to talk about the point source discharge hearing arrangements. So as discussed with the court, Mr. Pinter and Ms. Rademacher will appear at that hearing to answer any questions. And some parties have indicated that they do have questions for the River Authority witnesses, so that's understood. And we're grateful for the court's indication that can occur by AVL, and that's an open hearing which ends in being in touch with the registrar about that. In terms of the background and role of the River Authority, Simon 16, and the River Authority adopts the Council's summary of the background and development of the plan change, including the treaty settlement arrangements and Te Tiri Whaumata, which of course are the foundation for this plan change process. And we've provided a brief overview of those matters in our written submissions. Again, I don't want to take you through those in detail. Just at paragraph 19, though, we would emphasise a simple point that Te Tiri Whaumata, and indeed the Waikato River Authority, arise from the treaty settlement arrangements. And I know that that's front of mind for the court and the parties, as it should be. In terms of the purpose and functions of the River Authority, I'll take you to paragraph 25 on page 6 of our submissions. So while, of course, we're all here talking about the policy document, and that's really important, that's an important function for the River Authority, it has other roles as well. So Mr. Pinter explains in his evidence the River Authority's leading role in operational activities relating to the rivers. So that's funding and initiatives through the Waikato River Cleanup Trust. And we noted the evidence from Federated Farmers in respect of the River Authority's involvement in funding of initiatives, including stock exclusion fencing. So again, we're conscious that's been a real focus in these proceedings, and that the River Authority is well underway with those initiatives and has good familiarity with what is happening on farm and respect with fencing. terms of the involvement in PC1 in these appeals, the River Authority appreciated and wishes to emphasise the collaborative nature of the plan change process and the development of the plan change. And at 27, we've emphasised the direct involvement of the River Authority in that process. But turning to 25 and the statutory framework. So again, we with respect, adopt the Council's overview of that framework, including in particular the primacy of the 25 and of course the requirement that PC1 give effect to the 25. Again, recognising that that's the combination of objectives 1 and 2 make it clear that it's a first step. One thing I did want to note at paragraph 33 is Ms. Rademacher's evidence in respect of to 25 and its effect, and again, I don't understand there would be any dispute about this. But she emphasises that 25 is the only planning document overriding a national policy statement, and that's a deliberate departure from the usual planning hierarchy, and it's currently unique in the New Zealand planning program. And then the other thing we wanted to emphasise at paragraphs 36 and 37 is the restore and protect imperative of the 25. So Mr. Pinter explains the River Authority's view that the vision to restore and protect requires a fundamental shift in approach and practices, well beyond what is required to achieve sustainability. A form of betterment is required. And again, we adopt legal submissions for the Council in respect of the impact of the Pukekohe decision. And in my submission, it follows from Pukekohe that some form of betterment needs to be reflected in R&A planning documents, and of course that includes, in particular, PC1. So I'll turn to the provisions shortly. Just before I do that, and stepping away a little bit from the written submissions, I just wanted to give kind of an overall summary of the position of the River Authority in this process. So first of all, the River Authority generally supports the decision's version of Plan Change 1. And that reflects a collaborative development of the plan change and the very clear focus on Te Tiriti Whaumata through the process leading up to the Council level decision on PC1. In supporting the decision's version, the River Authority is accepting the compromises inherent in PC1. So I think we all accept that PC1 of itself does not give full effect to Te Tiriti Whaumata, but it's a very good start. And in that respect, sir, I recall from one of the judicial conferences your comments about ensuring we don't let the perfect be an enemy of the good. I apologise if I've misquoted you.
No, I think that's a general principle.
Yes. Well, the River Authority strongly endorses that. And the River Authority acknowledges the technical challenges at play in these proceedings. And understands and appreciates that the Council and a number of other parties have put significant effort into grappling with those challenges. The focus for the River Authority is defending, I suppose, the decision's vision. Not to say it can't be approved, but the fundamental tenets of the decision's vision. And getting PC1 operative.
So when you said the decision's version, you have a different view about the post-conferencing
view? Oh, sorry. No. Fair question, sir. No, I think as a general view, the River Authority was comfortable with the decision's version.
Yes.
An updated gloss on that view is that the River Authority supports the version now promoted by the Council and considers that as an improvement on the decision's version.
All right. So you generally support the post-conference version?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And in terms of getting the plan change operative and I suppose more broadly making improvements on the ground, so again, to emphasise that the River Authority is actively working with farmers in particular, along with the Regional Council, to take positive steps ahead of the plan change becoming operative, and including, in particular, fencing, and Mr. Peter talks about that in his evidence. On the other hand, though, there is evidence for, I think, Federated Farmers in particular, that while there is ongoing regulatory uncertainty, some farmers are delaying action. And that's understandable from a farmer's perspective, but certainly the river authorities keen to move on from that dynamic as soon as possible. And Mr. Trevilco, I think, also reflected on that, answering questions from my friend Ms. Kumaya. And finally, just emphasise that again, it's important there's no going back from the decisions division, and again, Sarah, as you said, for the River Authority, just confirming that the post-conferencing vision is seen as a good step forward in improvement. And as a matter of principle, the River Authority also welcomes further improvements to the extent that the court decides to make those. But I think it's safe to say is not actively pushing for further improvements beyond the post-conference inclusion, perhaps with one or two limited exceptions, which I'll come back to. So I'll move now to the provisions and the River Authority's position on those. So at 42, the authority acknowledges the council has remained firmly in support of key aspects of the decisions vision, and Mr. Penta has explained those key elements. I'll just read through those, which is managing the effects of the four contaminants that negatively impact the health and well-being of the rivers, achieving long-term contaminant reduction targets over an 80-year time frame, but with a particular focus on this initial 10-year time frame, and supporting lake protection and restoration. In terms of the objectives, the River Authority supports the five objectives as now proposed by the Council. Moving now to diffuse discharges. Again, the River Authority generally supports the provisions as proposed by the Council in terms of the management of diffuse discharges. And in particular, 48A and B, we wanted to highlight, first of all, the emphasis on lakes in Policy 1. So that's one example where we think there has been a significant improvement. And in particular, the reframing of Policy 1E. In our submission, that recognises the need to better protect and restore sensitive water bodies known to be significantly degraded. And then the second element there is that the offsetting and compensation policy direction remains strong. And I did listen with interest to the discussion that the court just had with Ms. Kizik about that. But fundamentally, Policy 5 in respect of the need to offset and compensate residual adverse effects from diffuse discharges, and Policy 12 in respect of point source discharges, those fundamentals are strongly supported by the River Authority. Because in my submission, there's a close link between offsetting and compensation, and in particular, appropriate offsetting and compensation that shows a clear net gain or overall positive. There's a close link between that and betterment in the political sense and in the two primary sense. But absolutely support the comments so far in the hearing that concept needs to be treated with particular rigour. Turning to overseer, so the River Authority has not produced technical evidence in this proceeding, so its focus is less on the niceties and nuances of the different potential tools. At the outset, what we do say though is that the limitations of overseer were known at the time of the council legal hearing and acknowledged, and we say carefully considered by the hearing panel. So certainly the starting point for the River Authority was comfort with the provisions as per the decisions version and the reliance on overseer in that version. but acknowledging that the council no longer supports the use of overseer thresholds and easy ones to calculate risk and apply activity status accordingly. And again, these are, you know, the possible alternatives, both overseer and its alternatives promoted by other parties, are highly technical, and the River Authority hasn't attempted to, in its own right, assess the relative merits of those tools and acknowledges that other parties have. At 53, so again, the focus of the River Authority is on the big picture, not to underplay, but of course the details lead us to the big picture, but the River Authority focus on restoring and protecting the rivers through meaningful regulatory and on-the-ground action. So in that case, the River Authority could support either the alternatives proposed by the council in the form they've proposed, with the proviso that that shouldn't lead to further delay, and I'll come back to that, or the use of overseer and PC1 as originally envisaged, or a combination of tools as has been discussed in the hearing. And again, the point being that most of the plan changes benefits won't be realised until PC1 is made operative, so that the focus point for the River Authority is choosing the tools or the mix of tools and then getting on and making the plan change operative. So, which of course brings us to the question of scope in section 293. And there's been a lot of discussion about during the hearing, and that's understandable. And my sense is that the court has expressed some level of unease about the use of the section 293 process, and I suppose in particular what level of delay that might lead to. And further, that the court is perhaps looking to explore options that retain overseer in some form so as to avoid the use of the section 293 process.
Yeah. Well, you could look at it in that way. I mean, one thing that we are looking at as we get into some of the detail is whether a section 293 process is in fact required in terms of whether or not the changes that are in the post-conferencing version and that are being discussed at this hearing amount to a change, well, in particular, amount to a change that would require essentially going back and having public notification of something, or whether the changes were contemplated in the course of the process, and that there is unlikely to be anybody who would be adversely affected who has not had an opportunity to participate. And I don't know whether the authority has a view in relation to those things, or if you would leave that maybe for the council or possibly some other parties to present any argument about. It just seems to us that the assumption that the changes, because they're reasonably big changes, necessarily require a further process as distinct from something being done in this hearing. We're not certain from what we can see in the Commissioner's decision and the notices of appeal follows without question.
Yes, well, I think primarily we would leave that to the council and others. I do have some reflections, though. I think as the starting point for the River Authority, the council has been reasonably clear that in their view, the changes they are proposing, they think requires, or that there's not scope for that. And certainly we respect that the council has interrogated that question a lot more intensely than we have. That said, absolutely welcome a process through this hearing of testing that assumption, because I think most of us would agree that if there's not a need for a section 293 process, that would probably be a good thing. In terms of the basic fairness point, the going out to give other people a say, I would just reflect that, I think perhaps it was Your Honour who reflected that there are a lot of parties, first of all, Plan Change 1 was a big process in itself. Everyone had the opportunity to pitch up, and I think it was reasonably clear that the use of tools was in play. Mm. Then through this process, we have a lot of representative parties. So I think it's fair to say that all relevant farming sectors are pretty well represented here. But again, acknowledging what I think Rob said, that that's not necessarily to say there won't be some individual farmer out there who might feel he or she isn't actually represented by someone. But I think within reason, there's pretty good representation of all farmers here.
Well, and in relation to that, sorry to interrupt, but in relation to that, it's not so much a question of whether or not any individual accepts that they're represented.
Mm.
You know, we don't need them to swear allegiance to
farmers
or Fish and Game.
Mm.
The issue is whether or not the concern that they have is adequately being raised and pursued by such a representative party. I mean, if this were a localised plan change, then we might well say, well, to what extent should the individuals who live in the neighbourhood be involved?
Mm.
This is effectively, even though it's catchment specific, it's effectively a region-wide plan change.
Yes.
So at that point, chasing down every individual, including those on the west coast, may well not be necessary.
Yes, and with respect, I support that distinction between a localised plan change process, perhaps with let's change the zoning of this property, versus here a much more conceptual high level process, and absolutely support your comment that perhaps I put it as my position that certainly most of the views on the merits of Overseer are represented in this room.
Yes. And you know, even though the AWA have not been accorded legal personality. The authority has been established in order to specifically represent and advocate for those resources.
Mm.
So the authority's view in relation to this is also an important one, as well as the views of those who are representing human actors in the country.
Mm. Yes, thank you. For that indication, sir. I think I can say for the authority that there's certainly the expertise in this hearing process to make good decisions on the appropriate tools to be applied in DC1. If the river authority is comfortable with that. And it may be that I think there was discussion earlier today about there being space for multiple tools, and that's certainly something the river authority would support.
Well, I mean, that is, I suppose, what launched us on the path of raising the question, because plainly the hearing commissioners have the idea of multiple tools in front of them, and the decision under appeal is explicit about that. And there are, I think, and I haven't gone through everything with a fine tooth comb, but I have found at least two notices of appeal that do relate to the question of using additional tools.
Mm.
And so, as I say, that's why I think that it may be a live issue, subject to the fairness assessment.
And picking up on that point, sir, my understanding, I hope I'm not misquoting my friend Mr. Conway, is that the council is more comfortable that a multiple tool framework is within scope. I think it's the complete removal of Overseer that is seen to be the scope issue.
Well, and that's where we have parties who have been pursuing the issue of alternative methods from the beginning.
Yes.
And so, I mean, again, it's not necessarily a question of the individual party in a plan appeal having all of the cards or all of the links in the chain. It's a question of whether or not all of the parties with the issues that they bring to the plan change can together put all of the links in the chain together.
So, yeah, with respect, I agree with that. So, I'll move on from Overseer. And just briefly on commercial vegetable production, I think it's fair to say this is another reasonably technical matter where the River Authority is largely relying on the council's expert position. And in simple terms, as I understand it, the CVP interests are seeking additional latitude in terms of the potential expansion and or rotation of CVP production. And in response, the council has taken a cautious approach to that, and the River Authority supports that cautious approach, especially in light of uncertainty about the flow and impacts of achieving what we will achieve. So duration consent. So this is the first of the issues where the River Authority does actually have specifically a different view to that of the council. So at 60 we explain that the River Authority generally supports the policy driving for a fixed duration of consents, and in my suggestion that's clearly appropriate here, and that shorter terms should be granted for consents sought just before the next plan change becomes operative. That said though, the River Authority doesn't support the general 15-year maximum term proposed by the council. And that's because that's a backward step from the decision's version. So the decision's version had a backstop of 2035, as I understand it. And if you play out the process from an operative date to the staggered requirement to seek consents to when those consents would expire, in pretty much all cases, a 15-year term of consent would go beyond 2035, and in some cases might go as far out as 2045. And in the context of a plan change that we all accept is something of a compromise, or at least as a first step, pushing out the time frame effectively of the operation of these provisions is in our submission not appropriate. So instead, without simply going back to the decisions version wording, what the River Authority would support, and this is reflected in Ms. Rodemaker's evidence, is a general 10-year maximum term rather than 15 years. And we've seen the provisions for federated farmers have also proposed a 2040 backstop in Policy 7 as well, as I understand it. And that pretty well reflects the decisions, the council level decisions, which have given the passage of time since then, and so the River Authority would support that as well. In terms of point source discharges, so again, the River Authority witnesses will return to answer questions. Subject to any indication to the contrary, I don't intend to present specific submissions at the point source discharges hearing. I don't want to take much time on that, but I'll very briefly note a couple of points here. So the simple fact is that the River Authority supports the provisions now proposed by the council. And at 65 in that list there are three policy matters that the River Authority has been focused on in respect of point source discharges. And in particular, that there shouldn't be any policy direction that one reasonable mixing will always be acceptable in all cases. Now, that's not to say that reasonable mixing is never acceptable. That's not the position of the River Authority. It's just the starting point shouldn't be, it's a given that there will always be a reasonable mixing done.
So it would depend on the location and nature of the point source discharge.
Yes, that's right. And then the other policy suggestion that the River Authority couldn't support, and I don't understand any party at this stage to be advocating for this, is that the effects of point source discharges, if they're residual effects, don't need to be offset or compensated for. And again, in our submission, that needs to cover effects in a reasonable mixing zone. So if you can demonstrate you need a reasonable mixing zone, that's fine, but you need to address the effects in that zone. Otherwise, we're going to struggle to get to a point where we have a river that swimmable along its entire length.
But these B and C, similarly, these
yes.
all appear to, again, not laying down a rule the other way either. These
correct.
All will turn on applications being made and being assessed
yes.
according to their context and circumstances.
That's right, sir. So, simply, I suppose to put it in simple terms, the River Authority supports applicants being able to demonstrate we can address all our effects and get them being given a reasonable latitude in doing so. Doesn't support applicants being able to say, don't worry about this particular type of index, just pretend there are defects there. Moving on to lakes and wetlands. So again, that's a particular point of focus for the River Authority, and we've heard some discussion about what's happened at the Tongariro and the wetland. That really highlights the issue we have with lakes and wetlands in this catchment. And Mr. Pinter explains that many lakes and wetlands within the catchment are significantly degraded and under sustained pressure. So the River Authority supports the Council's approach to these provisions and considers that the post-conferencing version does make good improvements to the decisions version on lakes and wetlands, and in doing so addresses the points of appeal for the River Authority. And we've also noted the Director General focus on lakes and wetlands and the discussion and evidence when you're in the hearing about that. I think Mr. Tribilco reiterated that the expert evidence for the council is that wetlands as small as 50 square metres have values. And that being the case, the River Authority's view is that those wetlands need to be protected and that the current provisions proposed by the council do that. And also reflecting on the discussion that we collectively don't know the impact in water quality terms of increasing the size thresholds for wetlands that need to be subject to setbacks under Schedule 7. And finally, I heard Dr. Robinson, for the Director General, say that in his view, setbacks are the most important factor for wetlands in Plan Change 1. So all that combines in my submission to lend significant support for the provisions as proposed by the Council. On Tangata Whenua ancestral land, so Mr. Pinter and the River Authority are very clear on acknowledging the long-standing grievances and challenges Tangata Whenua have faced in the ability to develop and utilise their land. And with that in mind, the River Authority supports the amendments now proposed by the Council to Objective 4 and Policy 18 in respect of in addition, the River Authority supports appeals seeking a discretionary activity status as opposed to the current non-compliance status for land use change applications in respect of Tangata Whenua ancestral land. And I'll just pause there again to reflect on some of the discussion. First of all, that support stems from the recognition of the historical challenges faced by mining in developing the land. And I think it's been re-emphasised during the hearing, there was discussion between various counsel and the court and Mr. Tribilco about the non-compliant activity status and how that might or might not enable any land use change applications for Tangata Whenua ancestral land. And my takeaway from that discussion in the round was that Mr. Tribilco personally sees that there's room for an application to pass through the Section 104 dead gateway, but that he recognises that other planners at the council, either now or in the future, might not share that view. And so, in our submission, with that in mind, it's better to remove the doubt and move to a discretionary activity status. And of course, that still means considering all the effects of the application, but just perhaps better giving effect to the policy direction in Plan Change 1 to enable the use of Tangata Whenua ancestral land.
It's a pity that there seem to be among a lot of people, certainly handling applications, this assumption that
respectfully agree. So without getting into too much
no,
discussion.
But I'm really just saying that in response to your submission and acknowledging that it does mean that for better or worse, care needs to be taken with allocating an activity status so as not to predetermine effectively the outcome of an application.
Yes. Okay. I mean, in my view, there is enough in policy to hook into, but absolutely that's not taken away from my suggestion. So we're better to be clear about it and not let these applications be knocked out of the first hurdle, and I don't think that's the intention.
Just on
the
two messages, Mr. Ryan, the thing that in your submission obviously said, which is helpful, what it doesn't talk to, though, is the issue around the definition of what kind of female sexual land should or should not be. And I wonder if you had a view about some of the discussion you would have heard me having with Mr. Trudeau and Mr. Conway about expanding that definition to include general land that is within the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court.
I do, sir. Thank you for asking. That's actually my next speaking point. I appreciate the question, and I have spoken with Mr. Penta and the team about that in reaction to the discussion that's been had in the hearing. So I think, well, certainly my submission and the view of the River Authority is that when talking about treaty settlement land, I think the definition currently says land returned by a treaty settlement, and certainly I can see on reflection the potential uncertainty as to whether or not that covers land made available by a treaty settlement, so the right of first refusal land, for example.
Yeah.
And the River Authority's position confirmed is that the definition should cover all land made available by a treaty settlement, that must be the intention.
So not specifically saying general land under the jurisdiction of the Certificate of Māori, but expanding the definition to include lands provided by way of settlement and that but may also be by virtue of settlement.
Yes. Yes, sir. And I think the River Authority does see there's a slight difference between saying all treaty settlement land should be captured. And another class of potential expansion to all general land owned by Māori, which might be getting into the realm of uncertain implications in terms of achieving Te Tiriti Whaimana at this stage.
Right, that's all.
So there hasn't been much discussion about Policy 19, and that's probably a good thing. I don't think there's any dispute about it, but I did just want to reiterate that the River Authority supports that policy and thinks it's really important. So while there's no objective to achieve the Te Tiriti Whaimana, and the River Authority accepts that, a policy here that is specifically about the advancement of the objectives of the Te Tiriti Whaimana is a good thing. So I'll turn now to the minimum farming standards in Schedule C. So the River Authority generally supports Schedule C as now proposed by the Council, and in our submissions we comment on slope, I'll come back to that, and fencing setback distances, which have kind of been my impression the two main points of discussion in respect of those minimum farming standards. So at 76, we say that as a general comment, we emphasise the importance of stock exclusion as an on-farm practice that can drive real improvement for the restoration and protection of the rivers, and they're described in PC1 as a priority mitigation action. So, you know, moving away a little bit from overseer and the Fonterra model, in pragmatic, easily understandable terms, keeping stock away from streams, lakes, wetlands is kind of what it's all about, really. As the plan change explains, is a priority action. So in terms of slope, and this is, I think, the second and only other issue where the River Authority has a different view to the council specifically. So the decision version, of course, provides for stock exclusion requirements to apply on land with a slope up to 15 degrees, and the council now proposes to amend that to 10 degrees. In simple terms, the River Authority doesn't support that because that's a backward step, and unambiguously and quite clearly a backward step from the decision's version. And the River Authority is concerned that there hasn't been any real analysis of the impacts of that change in terms of meeting the 10-year targets. So, in his evidence, Mr. Trebilco says that change is based on the availability of NFE maps, and the DECC doesn't know what the impacts of the change will be on water quality. But, in fairness to Mr. Trebilco, I did want to make two initial points. One, I think he's been quite clear and open that he doesn't have a particularly strong view on the 10 degree versus 15 degree question. I think he said that in response to my friend, Mr. Manhattan. And then in discussion with, I think it was Commissioner Maven who raised the alternative maps that may well solve the mapping challenge. I think it's fair to say Mr. Trebilco was open to that possibility. So it does seem like the council's proposed change from 15 degrees to 10 degrees was really just an implementability change. And it may be that that is becoming less of a challenge. And if so, maybe not such a might not be so difficult to go back to the decisions within 15 degrees, and certainly the River Authority supports that. And then in terms of setback distances, so this is where the council has proposed a change, and that's to a setback distance of 10 metres from named lakes and wetlands. So it's not exactly what the River Authority sought its appeal. But the River Authority does support that change, and that change would resolve the River Authority's appeal on that matter. Just briefly on farm environment plans, I'll keep this pretty simple. The River Authority supports the provisions as proposed by the Council in respect of farm environment plans. I wonder if I might reflect on the scope issue in respect of farm environment plans as well, and the alignment between the provisions here and the freshwater farm regulations. And again, I haven't thought as hard about this as Mr. Conway and others, but I think Commissioner Hodges raised the question, is there really a scope issue here? And I would simply say that as a matter of principle, if what we're looking at is updates to provisions that A, specify that the freshwater farm plan regulations must be complied with, while B, retaining requirements from the decisions version that go beyond that, then I can understand the question, is that really a scope issue? And in my submission, perhaps not. So I think it's clear that PC1 can be more stringent than the freshwater farm plan regulations. It's clear that everyone must comply with the freshwater farm plan regulations, so I'm not sure there's a scope issue in this plan saying that while retaining those more stringent provisions as well.
And again, from a fairness point of view, the issue of this aspect of farm environment plans has been in front of all of the people of the region from the very beginning.
That's right, sir. So again, I don't think there's anything being discussed here that should be a particular surprise to anyone who would be affected by the provisions. And certainly it seems to me that the driver of the change is to make things clearer for people who will have to use farm environment plans. And I hope that that in itself doesn't... I appreciate the council's caution about scope issues and fully respect that, but I would hope that that in itself doesn't create a situation where you need to go through a section to run through process.
And again, ultimately, each farm environment plan will be specific to the party that needs to prepare one and have it certified or otherwise go through a consent process in relation.
Of course. And finally, on the table, so I'll just state simply that The River Authority supports the tables in PC1 as now proposed by the Council, and in particular that relates to the reprioritisation, which we say has appropriately emphasised the importance of the lakes and getting the consent process underway and respect of all lakes as soon as possible.
Presumably your client has been involved in the whole process of identifying and prioritising, given its responsibility for...
That's what I said. And just the people we have to talk to. So those are my submissions, sir, and I'm just happy to take any questions.
I've asked several things on the way through this thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. First of all, thank you for your submissions. They were nice and concise and pretty clear. And a couple of the questions I had been answered on the way through by expanding comments. There are a couple of issues, and the slope issue, for example, and you will have heard that I've always been looking at the practicability of these things.
Yes.
And they may well need, I can't see how we're not going to have a need to have some kind of things that need to be done first until we get the best outcome. Would you have a concern in relation to the 10 to 15 degrees slope issue if that took a slightly longer time to achieve, if that was necessary? We haven't debated that at all. I'm just seeing that we're going to have to discuss a lot of these things to see what's the best way to go forward.
It's a fair question, Commissioner. I think I'll lead off by saying I suggest you ask Mr. Penn to that question. So he thinks carefully about these things, including because of the involvement of the River Authority with fencing. I think what the River Authority has strived for all the way through is we must restore and protect the river, that's priority one. But understanding there is a degree of pragmatism. I don't want to take the word pragmatism too far, but the community does need to be brought along this journey. So I don't think the River Authority is looking for provisions that are in practice not going to be implementable. So we do, the provision needs to drive the necessary behavioural changes, but it may be that some form of staging within the provisions is appropriate. But like I say, I suggest you ask Mr. Peter about that.
That's helpful, thank you. Now there's been quite a lot of discussion about whether the Papa Marino should be its own FMU. Do you have a view on that?
Another fair question. I've spoken to Mr. Penter about that as well. So I think certainly, without wanting to cop out, Commissioner, I think certainly the River Authority would not be opposed to that concept. And I know from Mr. Penter's perspective that anything that brings focus and attention to the Whanga Marino wetland, which surrounds our wetland, is good. On the other hand, and to be fair to the Council, the River Authority hasn't pushed hard for the Whanga Marino to have its own FMU status and is reasonably comfortable that it doesn't. But like I say, if the panel considers that to be the right outcome, certainly won't have any complaints from the River Authority.
Okay, but from my personal point of view, I don't see how that could be done as part of this plan. We could perhaps give a signal to the Council that they need to look at it carefully in the next plan.
That sounds, I respectfully agree with that. I confess I haven't worked through the technical details, but I certainly acknowledge it does seem like a reasonably big change to the provisions to go there at this stage.
Just one last question that's been exercising my mind as a group is a question of TWA health
in
Cranola Land and the constraints imposed until there is some headroom. Because with the best will in the world, there's a potential that if there's no room and you're still on the reduction of the schedule, it's maybe more difficult to get an allocation of contaminants. And again, it's not something that we can do in this particular plan, but do you have any thoughts on, have you given any consideration to that issue as an authority?
Another good question, Commissioner. I think probably not to the level of detail that you're interested in. I think that what the River Authority has thought about is the concept that there should be the opportunity for Tangata Whenua to make good use of their land while demonstrating that the effects of doing so can be managed, hence the support for the discretionary activity status. Beyond that, I'm a little bit low for a review about Ms. Rubbermack may have a view, or may not, I'm not sure. So I'll call Mr. Pinter.
Just as a matter of housekeeping, sir, while the witness is coming up, I understand from the back of the room that it's a little bit difficult to hear Commissioner Hodges this afternoon. I'm not sure
if you've been
shifted
yes.
or something like that.
I do apologise. I've been told that I talk too quietly.
Yeah.
My wife tells me I sometimes talk too loudly.
But I think the people at the bank room are having a little bit of difficulty hearing you.
I do apologise, and I'll try and remember to be better in the future. Just, if you can't hear me, please raise your hand, and that'll make me realise that I've got to speak up. Thank you.
Do you swear by Almighty God that the evidence you're about to give for this court shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Mr. Pinter?
Nothing.
Your full name is Robert Ray Pinter?
Yes.
And you've prepared two statements of evidence, one dated 28 July 2023 and the other 11 August 2023.
Correct.
Do you have any corrections or amendments to make to your evidence?
No, I do not.
And can you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge?
Yes, I do.
All right, good way. Stay there and ask, answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Just to any questions for us?
No questions.
No? Thank you. Mr. Pinnell, any questions for Mr. Pinter?
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Mahoney?
No, Your Honour.
Thank you. Lockheel?
No, Your Honour.
No, thank you. Mr. Matheson? Ms. Carruthers?
None for me, thank you, sir.
Zomley for Fish and Game.
Yes, thank you.
Very good.
Good afternoon, Mr. Pinter. So at paragraph 6.37 of your evidence in chief, you talk about the context of Te Tiri Whaimana, where lakes are known to be significantly degraded and it's not appropriate to wait up to 5 years before any steps are taken for lakes beyond the minimum farming standard. And then you say that Ms. Rademaker will make some further comment on that. And then in your rebuttal evidence at paragraph 3.11, you confirm that the authorities supported the appeal by Fish and Game to prioritise several high quality lakes, and that's in the prioritisation table for FEPs, isn't it? And that related to three particular sub-catchments where Mr. Clean had a concern that the favourite focused upon those high-quality lakes could turn from a macrophyte, clearer state to a turbid, algal-dominated state. So, just focusing on lakes, the joint witness statement for lakes, which was day two of those experts convening. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this, at question 5, said many lakes will require significant reductions in external nutrient loads to simply maintain the current inlake water quality. And that's referring to the LOF attribute state. So to simply maintain the quality of water in lakes, many lakes will require significant reductions in loads. And were you listening last week? All right, so these may be better addressed to Ms. Rademacher, but Mr. Clee for Fish and Game has set out a table in his evidence and has agreed with Ms. Starsbrook that you can ascertain from the current monitoring network baseline states for 31 monitored lakes. And there's an issue between Fish and Game and the Council about whether those baseline states should be included within PC1 along with the maintain objective for those 31 lakes, and the baseline states are for various attributes. Do you feel comfortable commenting on that issue, or would you prefer to leave that to Ms. Rademacher?
I'm neither an ecologist or an ecologist in terms of lake ecology, so I wouldn't be
able to comment on that. Right. But you would agree, wouldn't you, that there should be a maintain water quality objective, at the very least for lakes in PC1.
Certainly don't want to see lake water quality go backwards, so absolutely.
Thank you. Now, Fish and Game's still seeking a 20 metre setback from 59 named lakes in the PC1 area on the basis of Dr. Simon Stewart's evidence. And did I hear you say that the River Authority is content with the 10 metre setback from those named lakes?
I think I've heard Mr. Ryan sum up our position on that quite well. And so the answer is yes, it's going to come forward again.
Right, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Ferguson?
Yes, I have a few questions, sir.
You'll be here.